podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Buzz Podcast. I'm Trev Denny. I'm joined by Dave Hendrick, and we're here to do a kind of wrap up of True Detective Season 4. We've done, obviously, as you know, a companion series episode by episode, and we thought there were a couple of things that were left maybe unengaged with, or that we had a few questions about that we couldn't possibly get into because episode 6 was so detailed. There were so many things happening. And Dave, I've noticed over the course of the week that a lot of people seem to be very deflated by the finale. The two people at work who are watching it, who were mad into it, watching it with me, their take was, oh, I'm disappointed. And I said to them, did you watch it a second time? And they both said no. And I said, you will get way more out of it when you watch it a second time. But they weren't having it. They felt like it should all be clear. They had all the same frustrations that we spoke about last week that were kind of, at least, if not clarified, at least somewhat ameliorated or relieved by the second viewing. What's been your experience during the week of the general feedback now it's over?
Yeah, fairly similar. Like talking to some people on social media, talking to some mates and that, and they were very much the same. And when I suggested to them that they give it a second watch, they said, but why should I give it a second watch? Like, I don't do that with any other show. Why should I do it with this? Why can't it all just be explained to me? Which I think is a fair criticism. Like,
it is.
Most people, like, let's be honest now. The only reason you or me, or you watched every episode twice, but the only reason you did that was because you were doing this show.
Yeah.
If you hadn't been doing the companion podcasts, you likely wouldn't have watched them all the second time. So you would have missed out on a lot of crucial detail. And I can see now why people would be frustrated, because there is a lot of stuff that you do only pick up the second time through it. But I don't think that's just true of this show, because I remember when I first watched Game of Thrones, my missus had already seen it. She watched it when it was on, and I purposely avoided it when it was on because there was just too much hype around it. And my view of it was it can't possibly be as good as people were making out. And in reality, it was every bit as good, or if not better. But she saw a bunch of things, a bunch of details, and a bunch of little plot lines that she hadn't seen first time round. So there is definitely, in sort of a big effort like this, like this is a monumental effort to produce something like this, or any of the other seasons, or any of those other kind of shows. There's always going to be value in the second watch. So even if those people that you work with decide in 12 months to binge it and rewatch all 6 episodes back to back, on that second watch, they will most likely notice things that answer some of the questions they're left with right now.
I think that's a good point. And the only thing I would fear is that they were, both of them, so bent out of shape at not having their questions answered, which, I mean, Jesus Christ, surely that was coming a mile off, if you were just engaging with it on that kind of, I watch it when it comes out level. There was too much to wrap up. It was clear there was too much to wrap up. And yet I think they made a fair fist of wrapping it up. But again, it required that second viewing, and I don't think they're going to give it to it. I think they're going to have an overall impression of this show now, which will lead them to not view it again, I think is disappointing. And you see, in the critical response to it this week, if you just type in True Detective Season 4 finale, it's remarkable. It's, I would say, top heavy with frustration and negativity rather than celebration of what was great about it. And it is a little bit unfortunate. I think the show itself, you may agree with me, you may not, made itself a little bit of a hostage to fortune with the amount of stuff that was flagged up. There were so many angles. We spoke last week, you and I, about how perhaps the constant references to season 1 wasn't ultimately a net positive. But I think as well, in terms of just the many details and specifically the constant supernatural motifs that were coming up, everything from rolling oranges to pointing dead people to swirlies in the sky and on people's foreheads and everywhere else. And there was so much that people were waiting for this big holy shit revelation of the supernatural stuff. And I think people are genuinely disappointed they didn't get it. Now, I would argue, and again, tell me if I'm wrong here, that perhaps it is more than hinted at in the way the story has panned out, that you're supposed to assume, like I said to you last week, the worldview in which that supernatural is very much part of the story, but they're not explicit about saying it. And maybe I think people wanted them to.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it was. And I think a lot of people failed to make that connection between the scary supernatural stuff and then the spiritual supernatural stuff that Navarro and, you know, other people consistently refer to throughout the show. I thought they did well with the supernatural. I thought they balanced it quite well. So I wouldn't really have too many complaints there. But again, we've watched this show maybe a bit more in depth and with a bit more caution than others. You are right when you say there was a little bit too much leaning into season one, attempting to make maybe too many links as opposed to just paying homage to that incredible season. But I thought the one thing you can't criticize Issa Lopez and the others behind this show was you couldn't criticize them for a lack of ambition, because it's a very ambitious project that was, it was maybe a little bit too big in terms of scope to fit into 6 episodes. So maybe there were a couple of threads where they were trying to intertwine them and whatever else that just kind of got left unfinished.
Exactly. Now, I want to see where we'll go in terms of which of those threads you want to pluck on. I was very aware that all the way through, a huge amount of the commentary was about the fact that there was two female detectives and that the majority of the male characters were negative portrayals and all the rest of it. And we have had, I think, semi-intelligent discourse on that, you and I, over the course of our commentary on the season. But what I did this week was I just went to see what there was out there on this. And, of course, there is a HBO companion podcast, which obviously has access to all the people as part of the marketing package. Mm. This last one, part 6, was hosted by an Alaskan lady who is part of the native culture that's represented in the show. And that gets off into its own tangent in a second, which I'll mention briefly. But at the top of the show, there's a really interesting quote. I just want to play it for you in its entirety. It's about a minute, minute and a half. Stick with it, because I think it answers one of the big questions that was left at the end of the show, which is Navarro dead? Is Navarro alive? So listen to what Issa Lopez says about whether or not Navarro is dead or alive and see what you think. Because she's not answering that question, but she very explicitly says what she thinks the show is about in terms of the central characters. So here we go.
Well, the most important thing is a sense of no one will come to solve your problems. And the story that you create about your life has to be the story that you decide, the story that you tell. So the main characters in the show will come to face their deepest fears, and they will basically die and come back to life by facing those fears and understand that there is no reason to run away from your fears. That the only way through fear is by going right at it.
How about that, Dave? So both of the characters, in a way, either metaphorically or whatever, will die facing their fears and come out the far end, different people, better people. That's what the narrative arc is about. She also works in that concept of stories and narratives and the story that you tell yourself, and everyone has their own story. I thought that was really good because that ties up a couple of the ideas that we've already spoken about.
It does, very much so. And look, those companion pods that are put out by HBO, like you said, they're a marketing tool. They're fluff and bluster. But at the same time, for her to go on and give explanations is a big deal. So I do credit her for that. And she says what she says, you know? I mean, it is up to people to make their decisions on these things. Like, you can't have everything spoon-fed to you.
The subtitle of this particular episode, I think it's Emerging Light featuring, and basically it's about the fact that the native women are essentially the heroes of the story. There's a little nod every so often to how it's possibly a touch problematic that they, in inverted commas, kill scientists. But it's very heavy on the concept of empowerment. And they had interviews with the lady who plays Bea or Beatrice, and several other native, female native, activists who were working in and around the concept of missing or murdered Indigenous women. And there's a big discussion about that. And Beatrice is talking about how, you know, in her own life, this girl, this actress who plays Beatrice, talks about how in her own life, she's had these tragic examples of a niece going missing and someone else in her family murdered. And, you know, you come to understand that that particular theme and the kind of, I won't say lionization, but the kind of almost heroic conclusion that they're given, these women, where they get to gather together and rout these guys who are doing the damage to their community, is hugely important part of the story. And it may not have been immediately obvious to everybody, and there will be a lot of people who don't know about missing and murdered Indigenous women in places like Alaska, in places like Canada, in amongst the native communities there, and across the world, obviously. And so I thought, okay, right. Well, this actually gives it a whole new slant. And some people, you know, will get their nose out of joint because they don't want to be spoken at politically about anything ever. And some people will, I think, get an added satisfaction from that because she said, this lady, that she actually got the women that, who are all, you know, of the local Indigenous community who are taking part of the show, together, almost like in a huddle before that scene. And it was celebratory. It was kind of metaphorical for them. It's okay for us to be aggressive to men and to do this, that, and the other. And, you know, okay, that's fine. And I completely get where they're coming from. And I thought overall, my take on it, I didn't listen to the full thing because, you know, these things, like you said earlier on, they can be a bit fluffy, but they can also get marvelously preachy. And I completely got the message without having to have it in my head battered around 17 times with it. So I came away thinking, well, that's actually pretty cool. That's actually a pretty cool angle that people might know about then.
Yeah, 100%. And just so people are clear, according to the National Crime Information Center, in the year 2020 alone, 5,295 reports of missing American Native Indian or Alaskan Native women and girls were made in just 1 year. So we obviously, there's plenty of information out there if people want to read about the treatment of these people over centuries. And how, you know, I mean, look, let's be fair, all of their land was stolen from them and they were given back a pittance. And to this day, there are still thousands upon thousands of them who go missing. Just women, forgetting men and boys, who go missing every single year. So that's obviously something that Issa Lopez has leaned into here. I think, you know, there'll be some people who find themselves getting upset at seeing women empowered in this way as well. Like, you know, the same people who were upset by the fact that it was a show driven by two female leads, both of whom were promiscuous. Is that a fair word? Is
yeah.
The right word to use? And not just kind of straight laced. You know, those are the type of people who are going to be upset by this. And those are the type of people that you're probably generally happy that they're upset, because what are you getting upset? Why would you get bent out of shape by it? Like, I think this idea of a group of strong women banding together to take on a dreadful gang of lads who have A, killed their friend, and B, are poisoning their region and thus themselves, their children, everybody they know, I think it's great. Like, if it had been a gang of lads that got together and did it, there would have been celebrations. Isn't it great to see them fighting back? Look at the way they banded together. But why can't it be the same because it was a group of women? Like, why does it have to be different? Just because this is what happened in this area, in this show, it's no reason to be getting yourself wound up about it. It's, I think it plays well with the story.
It's a strong point of the show once you understand what's going on. And if you understand what's going on, you're still getting pissed about it, then as you suggest, perhaps you may want to have a little chat with yourself. And it's not just that, you see. It's also, it's not just the missing and murdered women. It's not just that angle. That's huge. And Annie Kay kind of represents that in a way. But it's also ideas of colonialism as represented by the mine, as represented by Salal, the guys coming in, taking over the land and doing with it what they will for their own ends. And you've got this mother goddess figure that these women all seem to revere and acknowledge. And there was a lot of talk about, you know, she and her and her daughter being killed in, you know, in that place, and she was always going to take revenge. And I just think when you factor in things like colonialism, you factor in the kind of all sorts of angles of oppression that people, indigenous peoples, have faced over the years. Yeah, it's a powerful statement, that whole sequence, that whole scene. But it does bring us to one of the thorny issues about the show and a question that I have for you. I hope you don't mind me going there. I know that could be seen as quite a serious little section, but I just think it's important to acknowledge it because you want to come out of this, I think, on the right side of history and understanding what it was that was trying to be spoken about here. So just thought it was right to go there, and your contribution very much appreciated on it. But here we go with the question. This mother goddess, Sedna, whether represented by that swirly serpent or whether actually that swirly serpent or whatever it happens to be, gods and goddesses, as we know in mythology and in history, can take various forms, and that's part of the appeal of them. Who killed the scientists? Because the question, who killed the scientists, I've seen in, let me see, where is it? It's Screen Rant is the website. And they're basically asking the question, True Detective, they say, doesn't answer how the scientists died. But these come across to me as a load of lads who've only watched the fucking show once or didn't watch it with enough attention, because here's what I'm going to say. My answer is the women washed their hands of it. They told their story. You could say that's a nice handy get out of jail card, which Beatrice presents with, they did it to themselves and we left their clothes there and all the rest of it. It seems quite disingenuous and quite devilish in its own way. They knew what they were doing. But it doesn't explain the horror and the fear and why they died with the expressions on their face and what was the idea of, you know, biting the limbs and all the rest of it.
Mm.
So we can only assume, can't we, that they came face to face with this goddess creature who took her vengeance on them simply by appearing to them and causing the same effect that seems to have happened to Otto Heiss as well. That's been my take. Am I completely missing the point?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's a couple of things at play here. I mean, you mentioned Sedna, who is the mistress of sea animals and mother of the sea in Inuit mythology. And obviously this is ice formed over the sea. So that's where she would come in. If you think back, though, Trev, to one of the first scenes of the show, possibly the very first scene of episode one, what happened? The caravan.
First scene. Oh, yeah, of course, over the cliff, yeah.
There is a master of caribou in Inuit mythology. Now, apologies, I am about to butcher this name in a manner that only I can. Tekketsertok, Tekketsertok.
Okay.
Tekketsertok, he is the master of caribou. So perhaps that points to that figure as well. There is also Qualortetang, Qualortetang, who is a weather spirit. So that figure in mythology is known to be a companion of Sedna. So I wonder, is the hint here that Sedna and Qualortetang, the spiritual figures in their belief system, that these are who have come together to kill these men, because the scientists killed the daughter of Sedna, how they viewed Annie Kay.
Mm.
And perhaps the companion has, in this story, come together with her to create this, you know, they talked about this storm, the freeze. What do they call it? They called it some sort of avalanche or something?
Slab avalanche, yeah.
A slab avalanche, a weather abnormality, which to me would point to this weather spirit.
Yeah. So, that's great. I like that.
That's kind of how I've just looked at it, because as we've said, there is the supernatural angle in this show and the spiritual angle in this show, but perhaps they're actually the same thing.
Yeah, that's 100% it, because it is, again, I keep coming back to that phrase because I can't think of a better one. It's the worldview, the cosmology of the people there. That's how they perceive existence. And it sounds, and I feel almost as if we've had to work too hard to do that, because again, just to try to be completely open to people who are being negative about it, the second thing they say here in this article is the finale confuses the show's stance on the supernatural by leaving the door open for actual supernatural intervention. Night Country muddied the waters about what kind of show True Detective actually is. Now, we know Nick Pizzolatto got his knickers in a twist about some parts of the show. Some people really disliked the supernatural angle, and I think the fact that it wasn't laid on with a trowel at the end, that there wasn't some sort of, I don't know, hazy kind of ghosty figure going, hey, I did all that shit. Maybe people can't put it together, but I feel like I didn't need anything more spelt out to me than that. People, the central characters were seeing things, visions were coming to them. They were being led in a certain direction. I mean, I'm not really sure what more people want. For me, as an Irish bloke like yourself, we're steeped in this stuff.
Mm.
It's just part of, you don't understand how steeped in it you are until it comes up in a conversation. You realize how much you have to say about it. And, you know, it was an easy fix. It was an easy understand, and I didn't find anything negative about it at all. So for people to say that the supernatural stuff isn't resolved, well, I mean, you can't resolve
supernatural stuff. Can't resolve it. That's the thing. That's the point of it.
Yeah.
Is that you can't resolve it. But I would disagree with the fact that they said that they kind of lent into it. I just think these people have watched it once and missed certain things that happened earlier in the show that were pointing in this direction.
What they wanted was, I think what an awful lot of these people wanted was a nuts and bolts detective story, which went in the end, at the end of the day, which I kept this sort of airy fairy stuff to a kind of explicable level. Although I think there are a few things in season one that are quite inexplicable. And by the time we get to the end of season one, Rust's entire cosmology of the universe has changed as well. So that's quite, I don't know that you can necessarily say it's entirely nuts and bolts. I don't think it is, but it's nuts and bolts enough for people to go, like me, a good detective show. The other thing I wanted to throw at you before I leave you to wrap up with a couple of thoughts you had was, I read another review. This was, I think, on Slate. Yeah, it was on Slate. It's written by a guy called Laird Barron, who I have wanted to do a short story of his for the Great Stories for quite a while. And if you're listening to this, Laird, you'll remember I had an over and back with Laird, and he was open to me using the story, and that was great. And then Laird's agent got involved, and there was a nominal fee, which Laird then wound back, and it was still way too much for me to do. I'm not in this for, you know, paying people to use their stuff. I'm trying to give people a platform and let people, a different type of audience perhaps, hear their stories. But the main thing to take away here is that this guy writes a good horror tale, and he's done a review in Slate of it, and it's essentially very, very positive, I must say. But there are a couple of cool little bits in it, and I wanted to read one or two of them to you just to see what you thought. Now, he does get into an awful lot of the references and what it could be compared to, and he loves this whole setting and how the setting itself becomes almost like a character. But have a go at this from a lad who is, you know, a bloke's bloke who writes horror stories. Listen to this paragraph, see what you think of it. Season 4 dispenses with the violent, broken, hyper-masculine protagonists of Season 1, inverting the formula by centering women and affording them greater agency in what is otherwise a classic mystery noir. Historically, this has been a male-dominated subgenre in terms of point-of-view characters, which makes Night Country and its take refreshing. He mentions then Smilla's Sense of Snow, which is a novel by Peter Hoag, and a 1997 film, each of which featured an alienated yet persistent female protagonist, certainly left tracks for Lopez to follow. The thing about noir is that irrespective of gender, everybody is generally in crisis. Characters react to trauma along a predictable spectrum. They self-medicate via sex and liquor or stronger. And when push comes to shove, hash is bound to get settled with violence. And I just thought, okay, well put, because maybe an awful lot of what is most jarring to some of the people was the fact that these women were acting like what we expect some of these hyper-masculine, broken protagonists that he mentions earlier on. Both these women are furious, raging women. They're violent. They have a moral compass that can possibly go off beam at times. They both, in their own different ways, self-medicate. Liz more obviously so. And I think it's really interesting. I thought that's a really good take. And it just said, I think it said in a different way what we've been saying from episode one.
Yeah, I think that's really good. I do. I think that's really good. And I think he's gotten to the crux of it. You know, and like, it is the stuff we've been talking about, where a lot of people were getting upset that these women were being almost, you know, in their minds, not saying this is how either of our thought processes were, but that these women were being almost cast in the roles of men, that the behaviors were more masculine than feminine. But that's because your mindset is in the 1980s or before, and you're not accepting the fact that women can be every bit as angry, every bit as rage-filled, every bit as violent, every bit as horny, every bit as alcohol-fueled as men. It's just we don't often get that portrayal in a major television production.
And I've gotten an opportunity here to get in some of my book nerdiness before we go to your whatever the takes you want to have are. A quick clock check. Sorry, this is mostly my fault, but I do want to get this in. I've during the week been listening on Audible to Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy, which was one of the books that was in the Salal station that was abandoned. And I will admit that I did not pick that up because I mentioned to you how I'd seen the Flann O'Brien book back in Lost and I was giddy about it. And I went back and read it on the back of that. I hadn't picked this up. This is what I love about us doing this show. And especially like would say something like Fatal Deviation. All these things just seem to click together. This is absolute synchronicity. This guy here, Laird Barron, mentions Blood Meridian and the character in it. This guy called Judge Holden, right? Now, Judge Holden is one of the most terrifying creatures ever committed to literature. I've never come across a more horrifying character in literature. I listened to the book twice during the week. It's incredibly powerful prose, but this one particular character is just terrifying. And here goes Laird Barron, and he puts together Cormac McCarthy's book, this particular character, and our show. Give it a listen. You don't need to comment, but I just want to throw it out there at the end for my wrap-up. So credit to Laird Barron for this. The orange mysteriously rolls back to her from the opposite direction, and we're reminded of an earlier scene featuring a close-up of a copy of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian from 1985, abandoned half-read at Salal Station. This conjures to mind a passage of the novel wherein Judge Holden, the big bad, enthralls a band of scalp hunters with his fireside meditation on the natures of God and man and warfare. He flings a coin into the desert night, only for the object to unerringly arc back into his hand. The recurring orange and coin suggest the mutability of physics, of reality at large. Time is circular. Distance, illusory, free will, a charade. All matter, all space, condenses to an origin point if your field of view is broad enough. Or maybe it's a parlor trick and we're all rubes. Chicanery and a magic bear, a close resemblance in the dark, the same could be argued of events in Ennis, the perspectives of its residents. And I love it because it roots this firmly in the uncanny, in the magical, in the supernatural, and that's where this show for me belongs. So I just want to read that out, say that it's nice to see someone whose writing I've admired kind of coming around full circle and agreeing, and a little reference there for people if they're looking for something to go and buy on their Audible next, seriously get on that. But be prepared to be disturbed. It's the most disturbing book I've read. Where did you want to take it to finish? I know you have a couple of things you wanted to hang your hat on.
So just as an aside on the Blood Meridian, and you mentioned the terrifying lead character, Judge Holden. Do you think Holden, the son of Danvers, the name is just an extra reference to that?
I think it's too much of a coincidence. You don't layer a show the way Issa Lopez layered this show. Now, quite what the relevance would be between a cute dead kid and one of the most terrific characters in the history of fiction, I'm not sure. But I think it could be just a nod. And again, remember what we said, the Times of Flat Circle stuff, Clarkie's take on the world about how Annie has been there. She's always been there. She always will be there. Maybe he was closer to the truth than maybe he was understanding Annie as this spirit and the spirit that will always be there, that has been and always will be, that kind of thing, that circular thing, or the idea of you know, parallel dimensions, parallel time zones, all those kind of things. Maybe the Holden here is sweet, but the other Holden, not so much. Maybe there's a version of Liz Danvers who's, you know, doesn't have that awakening to some kind of understanding. Maybe there's a version of Evangeline that just gets overpowered by that tempestuous rage that's in her and kills that guy who is abusing his wife. And that's the end of that story. She's in prison. You know what I mean? That there are different timelines possible here. And that's the kind of uncanny zone I like to think about this show in.
Yeah, and obviously we've seen in some of the flashbacks that there was a happy, smiling, dancing version of Danvers. And maybe like that's part of that as well, the yin to the yang.
Yeah.
So couple of things, right? So I looked at this piece on Collider.com, which was basically sort of the unanswered questions. So one of them is, what does the one-eyed polar bear represent? And we've talked about that, and it may just be the kid. That was the kid's favorite toy. It may just be the kid. And the reason both of them see the one-eyed polar bear is because it was Danvers' kid, but also because Navarro seems to have had the stuffed toy after Liz threw everything out. So there's that. There is how did Annie Kay's tongue end up at Salal? And again, we've talked about that, and it does sort of leave it open to interpretation, but I think we both came out that maybe it was Hank who cut the tongue out to try and throw people off the scent.
Do they again, have a take? Because I heard an interesting one on that podcast I was talking about, right? So the tongue is obviously the thing that tells the story, right?
Yeah.
You see where I'm going with that?
So, yeah, for sure.
So it's almost like this is Annie's tongue to tell Annie's story, right? So
there's a bigger story to tell here rather than just this girl got killed or whatever.
Yeah, possibly. It's an interesting take.
It definitely is. Another one is what happened to Navarro, and again we've talked about that, and obviously Issa Lopez has talked about that and given her explanation. So the two that I landed on. One I hadn't actually thought about was what happened to Oliver Tagak, because he just disappears.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there's no mention to him then afterwards, and it seemed like we might be leading up to him being somewhat of a central character as a main lead in the story. So maybe that's just one that they didn't quite give us the answer to. And the final one is something that I think might open it up, because obviously the way the show opened, there isn't going to be Night Country Season 2, the sequel. You wouldn't imagine. But potentially there's Night Country Season 2, the prequel, if they wanted to spin it off that way. And it's why are there so many strange things happening in Ennis. And maybe there is a prequel there set 50 or 60 years before the events of what we've just watched, that might play into that and kind of give us more of an idea as to why, and not just why they happen, but why the locals just kind of shrug it off and go, oh, well, it's Ennis. Because if those type of things happened where you live or where I live, you wouldn't just shrug it off and go, oh, yeah, sure, it's Navin or it's Cavan. You just wouldn't. Like, you just wouldn't be shrugging it off.
No,
so why are the people so conditioned to these incidents? Why are they so accepting that these things happen? And again, it might just very well be that deep down, beneath any denials of acceptance of it, that they all do accept and believe in the mythology, that they do lean into it and find comfort in it as a way of explaining certain things.
I love that, because that's exactly where I found myself every time. It's the only thing that makes any sense for me with this show, is that you have to sort of see it from that perspective. And, you know, that incidental characters like the supply driver can say stuff and speak to a young cop in a way that's kind of, you know, catch yourself on. You know what the answer is here. It's this place. The Rose can speak the way she does. For me, it's the only way to land with this. And when you do, you're left with an altogether more rewarding feeling and an altogether more rewarding experience in terms of trying to have some sort of coherence to it. And it cuts short an awful lot of the nonsense that I've seen in terms of negative reviews, because it's almost like a willful refusal to engage with that kind of stuff. And even just to ask the question there about, you know, well, why did they not resolve the supernatural stuff? Well, they resolve it as much as anyone needs it to be resolved if you want to go with it. And if you don't want to go with it, then I'm sorry there wasn't, you know, a mysterious witch in a black hat for you. I'm not sure what you needed there. And it's so much bigger than that. It's a more mystical thing than just like a cartoonish bad guy or bad girl. So yeah, I think we found a few things there which all seem to be pointing to the same kind of way of looking at it.
Yeah.
And listen, and to be honest with you, man, I would say at the end of our run here on it, entirely positive for me. We do admit there is the proviso that we have had the extra watch or the extra trundle through stuff to get those angles, perhaps, and perhaps it is a failing if solid people are watching the show and they've been really hooked in and then the payoff doesn't work for them. Maybe that's a very valid criticism, and I don't want to look down on those people. I want to just say that I think maybe, and I was really desperately trying to convince both of them, give it another go. And they're both refusing, like you were saying. It's that kind of, why should I?
Yeah.
I totally understand. I genuinely do understand that. So if that was your issue with it, that's the only recommendation I'd have, is to go and have another look at it. Maybe even something like this show might make you inclined to do so.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I would hope that anybody that's listened along as we've done these has found good value in us doing these. And you know, perhaps with a lot of the detailed notes that you had, that you've been able to point out things that, because they're hearing them before they watch the next episode, it's creating the bigger picture for them and just, you know, making some of the things that come up a little bit easier to understand. Whereas if you've missed a detail or two and something happens, you might be asking, well, why have they done that?
Yeah.
You know, what's the point of that? But if you have all the information, you might have gotten more enjoyment. And that's what I would hope. The last two things I wanted to say is, number one, I really liked how real the show felt, because we talked about it briefly, the relationship with Finn and his missus. Peter and his missus.
Yeah.
And how easy it was for them to sort of make up. And that's what real life is. Like, it's not some big dramatic thing. It's not big gestures. It's not, you know, getting to the brink of divorce and then that stuff that's done for dramatization in television, mostly in American television. And I liked the way the characters, they all just looked like normal people, Trev.
Yeah.
They didn't try and beautify any of them,
yeah,
which is, again, something that does bother me with a lot of US TV. Now, they've gotten better at it over the years, but I do still feel like you get in a lot of shows, there's always one or two people that have a minimal amount of talent, if any at all, and are clearly there for the aesthetic purposes. Whereas in this show, I felt like everybody was able to carry their own water. There wasn't, I didn't think, a weak performance among the cast. I thought everybody who was cast in this was cast based on their ability to play the role and carry the role without others having to carry them in scenes.
That's a great point. That's a great point. And, you know, I think it made it more relatable as a result. As you're so right. It's usually a handful of square jawed and oval faced, sort of corn fed types at the heart of most of these shows. Comically so, perhaps, in the likes of something like CSI back in the day, where you had, interestingly, Callie used to rock up there with her CSI kit and her beautifully flowing blonde hair, which is the most impractical thing ever at a crime scene. And those kind of things always kind of jar with you a little bit. And it's literally no comment on anyone individually in the show, but yet the ordinariness of them in terms of they look like regular folk, I thought that made it very, very relatable. There are actually two other things which we could easily have done another show on. You mentioned it way back at the start, which is the song and the opening credit sequence.
Yeah.
Those two things in tandem, however, really gave the truth to what Lopez was saying about everything being in front of you. Because only when you stop and see it and watch it now, every single aspect of the show is there. Every little kind of hint you might want is there. And the song, whether the lyrics are not quite as on the nose as perhaps, but they're pretty damn close to being on the nose. And they really do suggest an awful lot of the overriding themes of it as well. That refrain of bury a friend is very much a key idea. Going back to the opening little quote there, it played from Issa Lopez, these women who have to kind of, in a way, metaphorically die to be reborn. And all those constant things that are flashing up, you're thinking, well, they're just random things, right? Well, no. It's actually the whole story is right there in front of you. And again, this is why I think a second viewing will eventually, if you can find it in your patience level to go back and do it, if you haven't so far. Although I'd say if you're listening to us, you probably have and you've probably been loving it. Maybe the last one pissed you off. Yeah, I think that's the thing. That's my last piece of advice would be do give it the time to go and give it a second watch because it will reward it.
It will, without question. Now, I will admit there is I feel like I've been very positive towards the show overall. And I will admit there may have been a tinge of bias in my viewing of the show once I realized who the cast were, because there is a very strong Irish group in this cast. So we have Fiona Shaw, who is absolutely phenomenal as Rose. Fiona is from Cork, has been acting for years, has done everything across the genres. She's done TV, she's done stage, she's done film, and she is a phenomenal actress. You have Derv Le Kerwin, who, again, is Irish. She's from Dublin. She became known for Goodnight Sweetheart. She was the star in Ballykiss Angel for the first three seasons. And she's done some other very good work across the years as well. You have Owen MacDonald, who plays Clark. He's from Galway. He has done some really good stuff over the years. He was in Killing Eve, which I would highly recommend people watch. But one of the best parts about Owen is that his Wikipedia page was clearly written by an Irish person, because it says in 2016, he starred in Wrecking the Rising, about time-traveling gobdos who accidentally killed someone, which can only have been written by an Irish person. And then you have, as Peter, you have Finn Bennett. Now, Finn was born in England, but Finn is the son of Ronan Bennett, who is a writer from, a novelist and screenwriter from Northern Ireland, who is an immensely talented person who wrote Top Boy, which is a really, really good show. That was his second life. His first life, I will leave it to people to go and read about. But yeah, he is a very interesting character, a very, very talented writer. And I do feel like having three Irish and one British/Irish actors in this this show did make me want it to succeed. I want to see Irish people succeed in whatever it is they're doing. I'm not one of the begrudgers like the rest of the country. I want to see people do well. So when I see Fiona Shaw, when I see Derv Le Kerwin, and when I see Owen MacDonald, I want them to succeed. So I want the show to succeed. So maybe I was a touch biased in that regard, but I still think overall the show was really good in its own merits, regardless of the cast.
For one glorious, glorious second, I thought you were going to say that Finn Bennett was related to Jimmy Bennett, and I thought...
Which would have been magnificent. That would have... Finn Bennett.
Ah, no. And we will wrap it up on that. Thanks for joining us for our trip through True Detective Season 4. It's been massively enjoyable doing it for both of us, and we really do appreciate your feedback. More of that, please. And if there are anywhere where you can write reviews and rate, do all that kind of stuff, will you? It does help. And keep with us, because Dave's already got a couple of ideas for upcoming and hopefully popular shows that we can do. And we're obviously going to continue with our films. We're going to continue with our top 10 type things, and we'll probably do retrospective ones as well. I can see at some stage in the future a Season 1 True Detective companion series. I can see something, at least one thing about The Wire at some point. These are the kind of things that we both have in our wish list, should the show take off the way that we want it to. And the only ones who can do anything about that are you. If you like it, if you think your friend will like it, talk to them about it. Just word of mouth is often as good as anything else. You'd be amazed how that stuff can snowball. Like I said to you before, this is not our football content. It is not niche in that regard. It's open to everybody, and hopefully we're trying to pitch it at a level that most people will enjoy. So last word to Dave on this. True Detective, what's your wrap-up thoughts?
I really enjoyed the show. I thought it was big and brave and ambitious, which I think is always to be admired. I think it would have been very easy for Issa Lopez to do a nuts and bolts show like seasons 2 and 3, you know, not as ambitious as season 1, and just sort of put together a solid 6 or 7 out of 10 show. I think she aimed for a 10 out of 10 show. She didn't get there. But I think she put together a very, very good show. And I think if there was to be a prequel, I'd certainly watch it. If there's something else she does that's going to be of a similar scale, obviously not another True Detective, but something of a similar scale, I'll definitely be watching, because I think she's someone with immense talent, obviously genius level creativity, and maybe outside the guise of True Detective, she can express herself even more. So yeah, big fan.
I'm glad you said that, because I think, contrary to an awful lot of the snotty reviews I've seen, the pacing of that show is absolutely fantastic.
Phenomenal. Yeah.
I'm sorry, you're saying the opposite. You're looking to be negative. And I thought that's, in and of itself, that's a big win. So very much thumbs aloft from both of us for a show that was certainly, at the very worst, a qualified success and a great start for us in terms of launching these companion series. I've been Trev Denny. That was Dave Hendrick. This is Buzz, and stay tuned for the top 10 TV cops, which is going to be a second episode for this week. Talk to you soon. Sports Social Podcast Network.